Case Lawrence has tapped into something in the American psyche, a deep-seated desire to put down those phones and the tablets and just get away from passive consumption of media. Increasingly, Lawrence believes people want real, adrenaline-filled experiences, and they want to be able to share them with their friends. This was the premise under which, in 2011, Lawrence began Circus Tricks, a company that now manages over 80 extreme recreation parks across the U.S. and with some even in Asia and Europe. The parks allow guests to play dodgeball on trampolines, swing like Tarzan from rope to rope, or make acrobatic dives into pits of foam blocks. In short, everyone can live out his or her own American Ninja Warrior fantasy. Recently, Doug Wells sat down with Case Lawrence, the CEO and founder of Circus Tricks. His company is valued at more than $200 million now, and they spoke about how the company got started and what it's like to be a, quote, purveyor of awesome.
Case, welcome to The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
So your first park, before starting your first park, I should say, you were doing real estate development in the Bay Area. You chose a very tough time to do that. The financial crisis came, created a lot of challenges, and we'll probably get to that later in the conversation. But as you were wrapping up your real estate work, you went to a ball game with your kids. Afterwards, you went to a trampoline park, which was the inspiration for your company. What was it when you went to the trampoline park that you saw and said, this is a great idea, this could be a big business?
I think the thing that struck me on my first visit to my first trampoline park, it was called House of Air in San Francisco. And it was the mashup of all these different kinds of activities and sensory inputs. So it was an athletic, sporting venue. People were in workout clothes. People were sweating. It was an aesthetic environment. It felt like a club. There was art and an environment that had been meticulously put together. There was music. So there was kind of this energy and music there. And then there was this social interaction. In my case, I was with my boys, and we were competing and playing dodgeball and having fun together and interacting. And I saw it with others who were there. And so it was just this mashup of all these different things that I'd never seen together in one place like that. And it just really fueled my creative energy and captured my imagination about what else you could do to sort of take that to the next level. And so once I was captive to that creative obsession, I couldn't let it go.
You know, we live here in Utah. Most of our listeners are listening to this in Utah. We've got a fair number of trampoline parks here, but this is 2017. What was the world like back then when you went to the trampoline park? Were there a lot of them available, or was it kind of a brand new idea?
It was a brand new idea. I think the one I went to in San Francisco, I think there were less than 10 in the world at that time. And now, Doug, for reference,
there's probably at least 10 in the state of Utah.
Oh, there are easily. In fact, the estimate is that there's about 600 parks in the U.S. And so that shows you the pace and the cadence of growth and how quickly a new industry can form in America. When entrepreneurs take it and breathe air into it, it just goes so fast. It's been an interesting case study and observation point for me to be early in this industry and watch not just the growth of our company, Circus Tricks, but to watch the growth of this industry and how quickly that's happened, how quickly it's innovated and evolved and changed. And the dynamics that really shape an industry when it's young and growing quickly.
So when you were looking at the industry, it really wasn't an industry. It was a couple
That's
various
right.
locations. As you were doing your research, what were some of the things, you know, it goes from being a great experience with you and your boys to now you're looking at this as a business. So what were the things that you saw as really attractive from a business standpoint, and what were some of the biggest risks that you saw before you pulled the trigger to do it?
Well, I think you have to go back a little bit into my personal entrepreneurial journey, and you gave a great intro. You were kind to me. The reality was, you know, I was the epitome of a California real estate developer that was decimated in the recession. I was heavily in debt from a commercial standpoint. I had several projects under development at the time of the recession. Was working with several banks, two in particular that I had millions of dollars of commercial debt with. Spent 2 years of my life trying to do workouts with these banks. At one point, one of those banks was taken over by the FDIC, and it was really, you know, almost stereotypical of what was happening to anyone involved in real estate during that time. It was very dark, very bleak. I had built a career in real estate, and there really was no prospect that I would be able to continue doing real estate as a career. So I was desperate. I needed a new career pivot. I needed something to move forward in. And so my appetite for risk at that point was probably higher than it had been in the past, because I had to do something new. But to come back to your question, I think everyone thought I was crazy. No one had heard of these. No one had seen or could even visualize what this trampoline park thing was. And so the idea that I was going to put literally my last dollar in my savings account into creating one of these, people just thought I was nuts.
Yeah, it probably took more than your last dollar, right? You probably needed outside investors. I don't know if you own the locations or lease the locations. I would guess your first one for sure you leased
Absolutely.
To save on capital.
Yeah.
But talk to me about how you raised that additional money.
It's a great question. And, we hear the term bootstrapping often in entrepreneurship. I would call what I did... I would have to even give it a different term than that, because I absolutely scraped, borrowed, begged my way into doing this first park. The first park I did was called Skywalk. It was located in Madera, California, and it cost about $500,000 in capital. And I put all of my own money, emptied my savings account to put it in. I went to the vendor, the supplier of the trampoline equipment, and I told him, I said, listen, I don't have the capital to do this fully. I need you to not just be a vendor. I need you to be a partner and give me this equipment. I can give you this much money down, and then I want you to work with me, and I'm going to pay you on the back end. And we worked out a complicated way for me to get him paid back. I borrowed money from family members. I worked out deals with every one of the contractors and vendors on the project to have them sort of back end a lot of the money I owed them. So I literally scratched and clawed and taped and duct taped this thing together on the capital side.
Well, good for you for making that happen, because you talked about your experience in real estate and how that was painful. The whole country was going through situations like that, right?
Yeah.
The people you were talking to raise capital also saw the value of their 401ks plummeting.
Right.
So it was a very, very difficult time to raise capital.
Yeah.
It's often also a great time to start a new business if you can put the capital together. So your first location is really important. It's outside of Fresno. I'm not familiar
with
the town.
Central California. Yeah.
So why Central California?
Well, that's where I was living at the time. That was home. That's where I'm from. And so it was simply a matter of doing something in my backyard. And my aspirations for this were pretty humble. I remember sitting in the kitchen with my wife and saying, if I can make this thing generate $5,000 a month for our family, I would be absolutely happy, and it would give us some cash flow and frankly give me a bridge to then figure out what I was going to do with my life going forward. I didn't look at it as a company really then. I didn't look at it as a career. It was just a project that could maybe, an entrepreneurial project that could bridge me and my family for a year or so while I figured out what I was going to do with my life from there. And so that was my goal. If I could clear $5,000 a month, I was going to be fine. And I'll remember the second Saturday that we were open, I had the point of sale software up in front of me and I was watching as the day progressed. And I remember, I'll never forget, in that evening, we hit $11,000 for the day. And I knew at that point I had this recognition that I'm gonna be able to clear my $5,000 a month
nice.
From this project, and I was just overjoyed. It was so satisfying, and probably as satisfying as any of the more lucrative milestones we've hit along the way. It was really a relief.
You know, frankly, I'm surprised because Fresno I think of as a secondary market. You know, lower population, certainly not as much disposable income as in the Bay Area. How did people find out about your first park?
Well, that was, you know, a lot of the origins of our business and our playbook came from that first park. And because I didn't have a lot of money, I ventured into social media. And I'll remember, you know, I created a Facebook account for myself because of this Skywalk Park. I needed to get on Facebook and create a Facebook page for this company. And basically the only marketing, the only advertising that I did was on social media because I didn't have any money. And this was back before you even paid to, you know, Facebook to, you know, to really push likes or followers on a Facebook page. It was all still very free, and that was not lost on me. And so I spent a lot of time creating this Facebook page and pushing it and kind of learning the dynamics of what drove people to the page and what drove engagement in terms of what we posted on the page. And it was incredible. It was this whole new medium that I was experimenting with. And I remember at that time, this is only in 2011, but we forget, very few people I knew had a Facebook page in 2011. I was kind of this edgy dad who had a Facebook page, and all my kids' friends thought I was weird because I was the only dad they knew who had a Facebook page. Well, that's certainly changed, but at the time it was really unique. So it was all about social media for us, and that of course was the foundation of what has become our great strength as a company. Is we're probably known, you know, if there's a few things that we've done well, we are great at engaging on social media. And this was really pre-Instagram, pre-Snapchat. Now we're very active in those, on those channels as well. But back then, it was really just Facebook.
At what point did you realize, okay, this is you're going to hit your goal, a pretty modest goal, $5,000 a month, and now it's time to think about expanding?
Yeah. It's really interesting. I really was absolutely satisfied making my now more than $5,000 a month, fortunately. But I thought, hey, this is great. It did what I needed. I've had fun. I've learned a lot. And then my thoughts sort of turned again to what kind of serious profession now am I going to do for the rest of my life? And it was about that time when this couple who lived behind our Skywalk facility in Madera, they walked into the park one day and they asked for me, and we sat down and they said, listen, we live right behind your park and we have noticed the cars driving here. He was a commercial contractor and had a commercial construction business, which had likewise been taken out of business during the recession. And he said, we're ready to kind of retire, and our kids live on the East Coast. We're looking for a business concept, but we want to go to the East Coast. Would you be interested in trying to do one of these on the East Coast? And I thought about it, and I said, well, you know, I went to law school in Durham, North Carolina, and I know that market, and I kind of think it would do really well there with all the universities. And so I said, if you guys are willing to move to Durham, North Carolina, I would partner with you and do a park there. And I kind of thought that nothing would come of it. And the next thing I knew, I got a call from this gentleman. His name's Mike Carpenter. And he and his wife were in Durham, North Carolina, looking for homes. And they were very serious about doing this. And so it was an interesting gut check for me as an entrepreneur, because what it required was for me to take that $5,000 a month, literally every penny I was making from Skywalk, and double down at the table, meaning to put it all into this new park in Durham, North Carolina. But I had faith in the concept, and I knew, I had confidence. I knew if we could get it built, it was like Field of Dreams. If we build it, I knew the concept would be successful there. And so I put everything I had back into this new park in Durham, in partnership with this couple who really showed a lot of risk tolerance and fortitude to literally move their life to this new market and get this park started with me. And once again, the park was really successful. And that's when I knew we had a tiger by the tail. I knew this concept and the appeal of it transcended locations. It transcended markets. This was hitting at a deeper fundamental level of appeal for people.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Case Lawrence. He is the CEO and founder of Circus Tricks and operator of indoor trampoline and extreme recreation parks. So you knew you had a tiger by the tail. You knew this thing was growing. You had partners in Durham on the East Coast. Did they participate in future parks, or was their vision to just do one park?
Their vision was to do one park. And of course, with the success of the park called Defy Gravity in Durham, I was able to convince them to do others in North Carolina. So we ended up doing four Defy Gravity parks in North Carolina with the Carpenters, and had success in every one. And it was a great experience. And they were great partners, great colleagues, still great friends to this day. And so I credit them to some degree with the nudge to look beyond Skywalk, this first park in Central California, and to start looking to broader horizons for this concept. They were the nudge that kind of did that for me.
And I'm guessing that was not a franchise. That was just a separate partnership is the way
right.
You set that up.
Right.
But as you started thinking about expanding, did you stay with this partnership model? Did you decide to franchise? Did you keep it corporate owned? How did you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what it was is, I ended up doing my first five of these parks. One was in Central California, Skywalk, as we mentioned. The second one in North Carolina called Defy Gravity. And then I did one in Richmond, Virginia, Birmingham, Alabama, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. And all five of those were separate little partnerships. And I had to kind of the same theme and same process as my first one, which is I had to go find money and raise angel investment money. It was a little easier now because I had results from these first two parks. But what I found was the capital raising was killing me. It was so difficult to do that on for every project I wanted to do, I had to raise about $1 million. That's kind of what the cost of these had become at that point. And so that was a lot of money. And really this was not a concept that venture capital firms would look at yet. It was just too speculative. It wasn't really a technology company where a lot of the venture money was going. And so what I was forced to do is raise it from angel investors. And, the old maxim is true. You take 10 grand in investment from someone, you might as well take $1 million. They're very hands-on. They're concerned. And so maintaining relationships with all these angel investors and trying to keep that going, it just wouldn't scale. And so after I had done these first five and scraped together the money, the angel investment money to do that, I was ready to be done because I was just so worn out from trying to raise capital. And that's when I met Jason Peary in Palo Alto, and he's the principal of Peary Partners. One of those angel investors who had invested in one of our first five parks put me in contact with him. And we hit it off, and he came out and really had the vision as an investor to see that this could grow and had potential to really scale like a technology company or like some of the other investment opportunities that other venture firms in Palo Alto were looking at. And so Jason and his firm, Peary Partners, they were my first institutional investor, and they made a big bet on me and put a program together for us to just grow and not have any capital constraints in rolling these parks out. And that was really a key inflection point. I couldn't have gone further without the right capital partner at that time. And I really credit them with the vision and again, risk tolerance.
Yeah, well, you have the right background to have a relationship with a firm like that. We haven't talked about it, but you, in addition to being a real estate developer, you're an attorney, and you spent several years at one of the top law firms in the Bay Area, particularly in the startup space, Venture Law Group, which back when you were there was really one of the hot firms working with some really interesting clients. So you saw all this from the inside. I'm curious, did your new investor, did he take out the old investor so you didn't have to worry about maintaining those relationships?
No, we left the others in, and they were anxious to stay in.
Which they're glad about now.
They're really, really glad now. And so we really put a program together to, you know, where basically a big line where the capital was available to move quickly and move forward. And, you know, that gave me new life and new energy and new aspiration. And I really began, it was that point, Doug, that I really began to look at this as a company instead of a one-off project by project, to look at this like, hey, this is a company that can really grow and be successful. And so that set off a growth path over the next, you know, 3 to 4 years, where we were doing 10 to 12 parks a year.
It's a lot.
And it's a lot of parks, yeah. And a lot of travel, a lot of time away from my family. But it was just pure joy. It was so fun. And along the way, what we were seeing is that every single park, we knew exactly what was going to happen when we opened that park. It was just going to kill it.
Running a successful business is fun.
Yeah, right?
I mean,
that's
right. You would have never guessed when you were at Duke Law School and then in the Bay Area that you'd end up in this business. But, you know, having a business that you've put your fingerprint on, that you're guiding, and having the predictability of saying, okay, here's what we're going to do, and just time after time you do it, is just fun.
And it really is.
Oftentimes it doesn't matter what industry it's in. It's just the ability to do that. What did you enjoy the most during that period of time?
Well, one of the great joys in our business is that we're in the business of fun, of play. And so to this day, I've never gotten over the joy that comes from introducing our concept to a community and opening the doors of a new park and watching the faces of kids and others as they interact with our creation for the first time. It's absolute ecstasy in my mind. I can't imagine a greater thrill.
That's Case Lawrence, the CEO and founder of Circus Tricks, an operator of indoor trampoline and extreme recreation parks, speaking recently with Doug Wells. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For the show this week, host Doug Wells is speaking with Case Lawrence, the CEO and founder of Circus Tricks. Lawrence says his company, that's based in Provo, Utah, was the first such parks to develop Ninja Warrior-themed obstacle courses in late 2011, just as the popular NBC television show American Ninja Warrior was catching on.
And I could see that there was a lot of interest and sort of a community forming around that Ninja Warrior culture. And so we tried to kind of morph it into a medium where people could participate in these parks, and it was a hit. It was really fun, and so that was a fun creative exercise, and we've continued to do that. you know, we've sort of been leaders in introducing the sport of parkour into the United States, which has been popular in Europe and Asia and elsewhere. And again, we kind of took that and thought creatively about how we could package that for an American consumer in an indoor entertainment environment. And again, we've had a lot of fun sort of introducing these new concepts in.
The next athlete certainly has the talent to do it. It's Kevin Ball, the stock trader from Scotts Valley, California. And what a meteoric rise he's had in the ninja world. 2 years ago, he started in the walk-on line. Now, there's a line to see him.
I know you did a relationship with Kevin Bull. Tell us about that relationship and how that played out in your parks.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mentioned we'd come up with this Ninja Warrior obstacle course attraction, and we were rolling that out in our parks and having, you know, a great response. People loved it. And so I remember we opened a new park in New Orleans, and it was the largest park in the country at the time. This is several years ago. And we were looking for kind of a promotional way to get the word out and get the buzz going about the park. And I actually made some calls, and I talked to a couple bookers about getting an NBA player to come out to the park for the opening. And New Orleans, you know, had an NBA team, and there were some players there from other markets who were available to come out. And they gave me the quote, and the cost was just astronomical. I mean, it was a six-figure sum to get one of these guys out for 3 hours to sign autographs. And I remember thinking about it, going, you know, we're not prepared to make that kind of investment for this facility. And so I reached out and instead called Kevin Bull. I didn't call him directly. There was a person I knew who knew Kevin, and I reached out.
So for folks in our audience that don't know who Kevin Bull is, tell us his background.
So Kevin Bull is one of the pioneers of the Ninja Warrior culture of the television show. He was the longest running consistent finalist on American Ninja Warrior. And he's also kind of been a networker and marshaller of that community. He knows all the other athletes and contestants. He's also very recognizable because he has alopecia and has a very distinct physical appearance. People remember him on the show, and he's done a lot of nonprofit work and used a lot of his you know, fame and attention on American Ninja Warrior to channel it toward his nonprofit, which works with children with alopecia. And so he's just a great guy and sort of the in this nascent, you know, emerging culture, kind of the most well-known figure, at least has been in this American Ninja Warrior culture. And so we reached out to him and said, hey, Kevin, would you mind coming out and signing some autographs and making an appearance and doing our ninja course here? And I'll probably embarrass Kevin. I asked him, I said, well, Kevin, how much would it cost for you to come and do that? And he said, I'll tell you what, if you pay for my plane ticket and give me $500, I'll come.
That sounds like a much better deal than six figures.
And I said, deal. And so Kevin came, and I'll never forget. So Kevin comes, and we put the word out on social media. And I kid you not, there was a line a mile long outside of our facility. And it was this revelation of what is going on and this recognition of this whole Ninja Warrior movement is so much bigger than people understand. And we had these six-year-old, seven-year-old kids coming up wanting autographs, wanting to wear a Kevin Bull shirt, and they were saying, I want to be an American Ninja Warrior. And that's when I knew, again, that this whole movement was undervalued in American culture and that we had something there. And so we went all in and became the first company to actually have a paid endorsement relationship with American Ninja Warrior. And so we sponsored Kevin Bull. He continues to work with our company to this day. And it's been a pleasure to work with. you know, they did a vignette on the in the finals of American Ninja Warrior about our relationship with Kevin. And I think it's been a positive thing for us, certainly, but also for that community that's coming. And now I think there are a lot of paid engagements and endorsements in that community.
Yeah, endorsements are just so powerful. It's a great way to build your brand. Speaking of brand, you have a dozen different brands. A lot of these locations have different names. What's the strategy behind that?
It's a great question, and I get asked about it all the time. And interestingly, it really goes to our origins and what we talked about earlier about social media. We have learned and have the conviction that it is easier for us to build momentum and build meaningful social media communities when we have a unique local brand that we can build around. And what we found is, although there's scale and there's power and value in a national brand, that it's a little bit harder to get the loyalty and the traction on a local level for our facilities going that model. So we actually prefer having a unique brand in each location, building a Facebook community around that local brand, building an Instagram community around that local brand, and building a Snapchat community around that local brand. So that's what we've learned and experienced and kind of our truth. It goes against typical branding strategy. And
I was going to say, it's a good thing you went to law school and not business school, because you would have never come up with that strategy.
Because all
the rhetoric is have a brand. Yeah. You know, there's economies of scale of doing that. So what year was that Kevin Bull signed up?
I think that was in 2014 that we originally signed up with Kevin Bull. And it's been a great pleasure to work with him.
And so less than 3 years later, in January of 2017, you had a private equity group approach you guys, Palladium Equity Partners. They decided to invest at another level to give you additional capital to continue growing. They also valued your company at $200 million. Congratulations on that. That's a big number. Did that seem surreal to you that in 6 years you had built a company worth $200 million?
Yes, it still does. And it was very surreal. It was also really validating, because that transition and that partnership with Palladium really was the sign to me that this was now a big business, a big company, and that our industry had come of age and was recognized by private equity and you know, very smart people, that this was here to stay in America and in our cultural fabric. And so that was really gratifying. And it's been a great learning experience for me to learn about business at the private equity level. And it really is at a level of sophistication and of analysis that I was not used to. And so it's been a great education for me. And it's provided the resources for us to grow to the next level. And I think that's really one of the lessons I've learned. And I have to say, for everything we've done, without having the right capital partners at the right time for our business, there's no way we would be where we are today. It you really know, is a symbiosis.
Capital is so important.
It's so important.
I don't know if you've read Phil Knight's book, Shoe Dog.
I have.
A common theme. It's a very well-written business book, but that's a common theme with just about every successful company.
Yeah.
And so getting that capital structure right, and it sounds like you got that right early on. We need to wrap up, but before we do, I was looking at your LinkedIn profile just as part of the research, and I saw you recently wrote an article that I want to ask you about. We're a business show. We're not a political show. The title of your article was Tax Policy That Can Compete. And I want to just focus on the corporate tax side of it. You make a very strong case for why corporate tax rates, why we as a country need to consider lowering those. And I want to give you a chance to share your thought on that.
Yeah, I really feel strongly about this in particular, the inversion issue. And what that is we've experienced this directly. As you mentioned at the beginning of the show, we have parks in Europe. We have parks in Asia. And the way the current system works is that once you deploy capital And we are, as we've discussed, a high CapEx business. You know, we have to put high amounts of capital into these facilities to get them open and put that investment in. Once you do that overseas as an American company, the current tax structure in America creates a virtual prison for your capital overseas. So it's very difficult to bring that capital back in a way that makes any business sense. And so what we found ourselves, I was confronted with this issue just in the last couple of years for the first time and really understood. It really influences our decisions. And so what we as a business do is just keep the capital over there. And so as we're making money on those European parks, it just makes sense to keep it over there instead of bringing that capital back and doing additional parks in the U.S. and creating jobs here. Those policies kind of create a gate, and the incentive for us as a company and for other companies is to try to keep that capital there and create new jobs for Germans or for people in the UK. And so I think that obviously policymakers don't intend for that to happen. And I think that some smart policymaking could remove those obstacles and create incentives for us to continue to venture internationally, but to have the opportunity to bring that capital back to create jobs in the United States. I think the world, as we know, is much flatter today than it was even 10, 15 years ago. Every company I'm aware of that's growing has international activity, has plans and growth internationally. And I think that, you know, the more you can take away artificial incentives that keep people from making good business decisions, I think that's in everyone's interest to do that. So it'll be interesting as the whole corporate tax debate continues. And I'll be following closely these inversion policies, because I think that's really, in our business specifically, has a big effect on us.
It's a complex issue, and it's something we're debating now as a society. So I do think we're going to see some resolution to that issue in the coming months. I'm curious. You're based here in Utah. You have no parks here in Utah. What was the reasoning behind coming to Utah?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was actually, you know, my wife is from Utah. I went to school here at BYU. As the company started to grow, or, you know, early on when we were on this growth tear and we were doing 10 to 12 parks a year, I was on the road a lot. And as a family, we really came to the conclusion that, you know, I could travel from anywhere and better to be where my wife and family were happy. And so we made the move back to Utah. We had some family dynamics driving that a little bit with my wife's family. And so we came back, and it was sort of coinciding with the time that we really needed to start building some corporate infrastructure as a company. And so this is where we were, and we started to build it. At the same time, Utah, we felt, was a little oversaturated for parks. And so we take very seriously our placement of these parks and where we're going. So we do have this interesting irony that we've built this empire of recreation parks. Our company is based in Utah. Our whole corporate team is here, and we don't have a park here. But that is about to change. We're going to announce a park this fall in Utah Valley, and we're excited about that. And we'll have more details about
that.
Well,
I'm glad you're breaking that news on our show here.
Right.
Thank you for sharing that. Case, thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
Case Lawrence is the CEO and founder of Circus Tricks. He spoke recently with Doug Wells. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and edited and produced by me. There's more to this conversation on our website and the podcast version of this show, so check it out. I'm Ross Chambliss. Join us next week on The Bottom Line. Want so much more. This is worth fighting for. Yes, I'll take a chance.